I'm Austin.
I'm Bridget.
And I'm Lauren. And this is Tipsy Ghouls, a podcast that searches your neck of the woods for the stories that keep you up at night about true crime, conspiracies, and you guessed it, ghosts.
So without further ado, let's get started. Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Hi.
How you doing?
Hello.
We got a little late night recording session.
Yes.
Yes.
A little sleepy.
It's not even that late. It's fucking 9:40.
It's really not.
Yeah.
I know. We act like we're like fucking 85 years old already.
I know. Do I wish like I could be in bed by now? Yes.
Absolutely.
But am I doing this because I love this podcast and I love our listeners? Also, yes.
Absolutely.
Yes, exactly. And because this is the most important thing in our lives. Yes.
Yes.
Totally.
Close
other than you guys being celebrities at a local bar.
What can I say?
You know, we're just blowing up.
When you
up,
say local bar. Local bar. We mean fancy cocktail bar.
Yes. Not your hometown bar where yes. you see
where
a guy from your high school getting drunk.
Where yeah. we were also celebrities.
Yes, but yeah. for different reasons. Different kinds of celebrities.
Yes.
Welcome to our Oklahoma episode, guys.
Yes, yes. We're finally out of Ohio, but
Art
we're
Ohio.
Still in the Midwest.
We made it. We yes. are. Where the yes. wind goes crashing down the plains.
Yes, Tornado Alley.
Yes. Literally the wind goes crashing down the plains. And yes. the cows and your mailbox.
And
yes.
your home. Your roof.
And your roof and maybe your bathtub and a lady riding a bicycle with
yes.
a beatbox on her shoulder that's just
yes.
playing dun da 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 da. Wait, that's Kansas.
Same shit.
Same difference.
The only thing I know about Oklahoma is that it was the only state in this past election that when you zoomed into onto the cities, they were also red.
Oh.
It was just all red. Oh, no.
That sounds oh, no. miserable.
I know.
The only thing I know about Oklahoma other than Tornado Alley is that my family went for a convention because, you know, church stuff. And they got convinced to try Rocky Mountain oysters, which they didn't know what
oh,
they were.
No.
And for our listeners who also oh, don't know God. What they are, in fact, cow testicles.
Gross.
Absolutely yeah, gross. Not.
It's the funniest thing.
That's gross.
Yes, it is. Disgusting.
Education is important.
Yes.
what Rocky Mountain oysters are before you go to Oklahoma.
Honestly.
I also have a question about Oklahoma. Who lives like on the little panhandle? Does anyone live there?
I don't know. Somebody.
Because it's probably actually really big, but on the map, it just looks so small.
It does.
Like what's
could
the
just,
point?
Like, walk 20 minutes and be in a different state.
Right.
Yeah.
Like literally, what's the point?
Yeah.
Let's see what cities are there.
I don't even think there's any.
It's just its own city.
It's called Handleville.
Handleville.
Panhandle'em.
Panhandleville. There's
Panhandleville.
Guymon. There's like a few.
Wait.
The main one is Boise City.
They had Guymon on Small Town Murder in the last episode. That's funny.
Oh,
weird.
Interesting.
Weird coincidences.
Speaking of Small Town Murder, not Small Town, I started watching the Night Stalker documentary on Netflix.
Oh, it's so good.
Oh, my gosh. That kind of put me to sleep.
Okay.
Like, it was
relaxing.
I know. That's how that and the Elisa Lam or the Cecil Hotel documentary, oh, my God, those put me to sleep.
Okay, that manager of the Cecil.
Yeah, she's
She
sketch.
Was creepy. Yeah,
she's
she was a bit much.
Mm-hmm. That was very interesting.
Well, since we don't know much about Oklahoma, I'm guessing that a good majority of the people that listen to this podcast probably don't know much about it either. So do you guys want to hear, or they're from there? I don't know. We don't actually know where you guys are from. So do you guys want to hear some fun facts about Oklahoma?
Yay. I love that.
This is our first fun facts in a month.
I know.
Yeah.
We forgot to do Ohio. Sure.
It's all right.
Whoops.
It's fine. So my first fun fact for Oklahoma is Oklahoma's official state meal, as set forth in 1988 by the House Concurrent Resolution, is black-eyed peas, chicken fried steak, okra, squash, corn on the cob, cornbread, barbecue pork, biscuits, sausage and gravy, grits, strawberries, and pecan pie.
Wow. Oh my God.
They have their own official state meal.
That's a huge meal.
It's a lot, yeah.
Yes. I like that strawberries are in there.
Yes, yes. Health. Yeah. Health.
Yes. And a
diet
Coke.
Need
a little bit of color in there.
Yeah.
My next fun fact is, because of the frequent sightings, there is an annual Bigfoot Festival in eastern Oklahoma.
Interesting.
That's cool. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. The voicemail was patented by a man from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Gordon Matthew created the technology in the 1970s and patented the VMX, or the Voice Mailbox Express, in the 1980s. So thank him for your spam voicemails. Yes.
It's kind of rude.
Oh, this one's a kind of interesting sciencey one. Back in the old days, we're talking Triassic old, Oklahoma was located near the equator.
Mm-hmm.
So it was hot.
Interesting.
Oh, it took me a second to understand that.
I know. Like, I was like wrapping my head around
dinosaurs. Dinosaurs.
Like, oh, the land was moved in a different place. I was like, oh, yeah.
It was part of Pan Am, right? Pan Am?
No, that's in the Hunger Games.
Pan Am. Well, it's been a long time since I've been in eighth grade, guys, okay?
That's in Pan Am. Right? District
4? District 12?
District 12.
Pangea.
Pangea. Pangea moved. Okay. Well, I was close. The state flower of Oklahoma is mistletoe.
Aww.
Lots of kissy-kissies going on. Oklahoma serves as headquarters for 39 American Indian tribes. Let's see. Please do not try and catch a whale in any of these man-made lakes that are in Oklahoma. Whaling is illegal in the state of Oklahoma, but I didn't know that was possible. So,
yeah, I don't think it is.
Thank God.
Yeah.
Too much.
And my last... yeah, too much. Too much whaling. Gotta save the whales in Oklahoma.
We gotta stop.
You gotta stop.
Mm-hmm. And my last fun fact about Oklahoma is home to some cities with silly names. Names including Loco, Kookie Town, Bushy Head, Corn, Moon, 41, and IXL.
Corn, Oklahoma.
That's where do you live? I live in Corn, Oklahoma.
That's like you point to it, like you bring a kindergartner in and you're like, name all these cities. Corn.
Kookie Head.
45.
Where are you from, Kookie Head?
Kookie Head.
You Kookie Head.
Loco.
That's funny as fuck.
I have one more fun fact to add just because I just looked it up. It only takes like 45 minutes to drive from the top to the bottom of the panhandle.
Hmm. Huh.
So it is like pretty tiny.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Travel between states in less than an hour.
Yes. Kansas, Texas, and Oklahoma all in an hour drive. Yes.
Or you could just get rid of the panhandle and just skip an extra step and just go from Kansas to Texas. But whatever.
Yeah.
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 Man, yeah, have you lived in the panhandle?
Yeah, that panhandle kind of pisses me off.
It's like, not
satisfying. For absolutely no reason. The panhandle pisses me off.
Like, now that I think about it, Yeah, for like literally no reason. It makes me mad. Like, why?
Yeah. But if you lived there, you could get access to everything. Kansas, true. Colorado, New Mexico, Texas, true, and true. Oklahoma.
You know what else doesn't piss me off?
What doesn't piss you off, Lauren?
The good things that are happening in our lives.
Yes, mm. yes.
Yes. So, Austin, why don't you tell me something good?
I have a few things. Not only am I fully vaccinated now, I'm going Woo! On a nice little vacation tomorrow that I kind of feel safe going to. Yay. I also, what else is good in my life right now? This is what I needed to tell you guys. You almost let me forget.
Yes.
I will be coming home in June.
Yay!
I'm so excited.
Yeah, yay! I'm coming home for my sister's birthdays, but I already told my mom that I'm reserving a day for you guys.
Yay!
So I'll see y'all in June. Yeah.
That's so soon, too.
Like, I know!
Finally, we'll get to go to Tinder Mercy together because I want to go there.
Yes.
And
I
can feel like a celebrity as well.
Yeah. Well, for me, something good is that every week I'm just like, what's something good that's going on in my life? Something good is that, oh God, Beach, you go.
Yeah, you could talk.
And I'll think about it. Yeah.
I have an array to pick from. Could talk about either the party we went to last night. That was fun. Or I was going to say that, but also Greta Van Fleet's album comes out tonight.
Okay, that'll
That's
be mine.
That's exciting.
Okay, yes.
That could be yours. Yes.
Okay. My son, because I want you to talk about the party, because you're the one that really made it a hit.
Oh, thank you. That's an overkill.
My good thing is that Greta Van Fleet's new album comes out tonight at midnight. So if you haven't listened to it yet, by the time this comes out on Tuesday, give her a listen. It's going to be really, really good.
And I have to be honest with you guys. I have never listened to Greta Van Fleet.
Ugh,
well,
you need
to. It's changing tonight then.
Interesting.
All right. I'll listen to it while I'm laying in my bed.
So good. Yes.
They have a couple new songs out from their new album that are really good, like Heat Above.
Oh,
like
love
good,
that
like,
one.
Feel good yeah. rock songs. And like they have a lot of like long rack, long rack ballads. Rock ballads. My something good was the event we went to last night. So two weeks ago, we talked about it on the podcast too, because we were about to go to Goth Night, me and Lauren and our friend Margo. At our like favorite bar, Tender Mercy, and we were sitting at the bar talking to Brandon, the bartender, and he was like, "You guys coming to my birthday party?"
The beverage director.
Sorry. Yes. He's like, "You guys coming to my birthday party?" And we're like, "It says invite only," and he's like, "Well, we're inviting you." And I was like, "Okay." So he invited us, and it's a cowpoke theme. But we were sitting there that night, like asking him what he wanted for his birthday, because they do so much nice stuff for us. Like, we just want to do something for him and Sabrina. We love her too. And he has a bunch of really unique tattoos, like a coffin with a Nike symbol on it and like some other fun things.
Just like random ones.
Yeah, like super random. And so we were joking that someone should come with all like fake tattoos of his and like dressed up as him. And he was like, that'd be a really good birthday gift. And we were like, you're right, it would be. So we had him send us pictures of his tattoos that are recognizable. And I took the pictures and like zoomed way in on Photoshop and like erased his skin and like turned them into fake tattoos and bought like tattoo transfer paper and printed them out and like made like the ones you put a little wet cloth on, like made those kind of tattoos of his actual
tattoos.
They
were legit.
That's crazy.
They were really legit. They were actually really easy to make, but they were really cool.
Yeah, it was super fun and it was a hit. Everyone loved it. I think those tattoos went in some very inappropriate places, which I'm here for. Because by the time we got there, it was 10 o'clock. It was like 10:30, and everyone was like already super drunk. So,
yeah.
All right.
And the owner of Cheeks had some all over his face, apparently. So I call that a success. Well,
love to hear it. Love to hear it.
Yes.
And yeah, for people who don't know, Cheeks is a strip club down in these parts.
Mm-hmm.
So
down in these here parts.
Cheeks Gentleman's Club.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
You know what else we can do when you're in town? Is
what can we do, Bridget? What can we do?
Drink alcohol.
What?
Love it.
Us?
Love it.
Burr, 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 burr. I know.
Groundbreaking.
Right?
Iconic. Never before seen.
Never been done before.
I just had this new idea. I don't know. Like, you know, it's like kind of crazy, but I was like, oh my God, you know what we could do?
Twist my arm.
Oh.
Well, I am not drinking alcohol tonight. I'm drinking water. But,
oh, that's good. Good stuff.
A drink that we haven't gotten a chance to talk about yet, which is definitely the drink of the summer.
Yes. Summer drink 2021.
Yes. Which we first had them on goth night, and they had them last night too, was at Tender Mercy, they do bottle service for a 40 of Miller High Life, which is already hilarious. So on goth night, we were having like a couple of those. And Brandon was like, can I just make you something else with that? Like, sure. And so it made us a spaghetti, which I've never had before. So you take Miller High Life and you pour out some of it, like maybe take like a couple swigs of it. And you put in like an ounce and a half of Aperol and like a half ounce of lemon juice. And it's like a like poor man's Aperol spritz.
It's
that is the
so
most
good.
Yeehaw Ohio thing I've ever heard.
But it's so
so good.
Especially considering that you just added maybe take a little bit of it out or take a few swigs.
Yes, exactly. You make it in the
swigs.
Bottle so it looks pretty
the swigs,
in the bottle.
The swigs. Specifically.
Exactly.
Swigs only swigs here. No thoughts, just swigs.
Merch. That's a merch idea. No, it's just swigs. Because it can't be a couple sips. That's not enough. It got to be a couple swigs.
Yeah.
But it's so good.
It's good.
It's not enough Aperol to be bitter like Aperol usually is. It just kind of tastes like orange creamsicle kind of.
It's very really good.
Can't wait to try it.
Yes. The drink of the summer. And I had a great idea. Sorry, I'm just rambling at this point. I had a really good idea of how to make them in the summer. That Lauren has that flask cap thing where you put liquor in the top. And you could put like the Aperol and the lemon juice in the top for a couple of them. And then you can just like pushing your butt little button and like making little spaghettis in your little thermos thing. Oh,
so good. I'm so see over here. I was thinking like, yeah, we can make it in a Gatorade jug.
Yes, that too.
Oh, God.
Depends on the event. Depends, you know, who, what situation we're in.
Are we 2022 again?
Yes. Turns out getting drunk on Wednesdays.
Turns out
our reservation was at 10 o'clock. Do you know how long it's been since we went to the bar at 10?
Literally.
A very long time.
Very long time. But it was fun.
I don't go. I have to force myself to hang out with people when I get off work at 8:30.
I know.
Yeah. We only took that time slot out of desperation because it was the only one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, that's what I'm drinking.
I'm also drinking water, but I need to show you guys something.
Okay.
So last night I came home and I'm like trying to find a water cup that's like big enough for my thirst because I couldn't find any water bottles that I own. And this is what happened to it. It has the tattoos on it.
Oh, that's amazing.
That's such a good idea.
No, because I was laying in bed and I forgot to take them off and I didn't. Like, I had the water bottle next to me, so I just, like, took it off and stuck it on the lid.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if they're going to come off.
Oh, my God.
But that's kind of legit.
Yeah. That's cool. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, those are kind of cool.
Yeah.
I'm actually drinking because I haven't had a drink since I got my COVID shot. And I'm just drinking some 10-cup rye. On the rocks because I'm a
fancy.
I'm a bourbon
fancy
boy.
yeah yes, and I'm glad we had a good laugh before my topic because it's a little sad.
Oh, sorry. No,
I'm sorry.
It's all right.
It's actually really sad.
Oklahoma is kind of a sad place. Sorry if you're
true.
From Oklahoma.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure our listeners would agree.
I didn't look too far for a topic because this one was definitely important. It's not really even a conspiracy, but it is, the history of it is, but not the actual event. This actually happened 100%. So my sources for this story are the New York Times and history.com. And I'm going to be talking about the Tulsa Race Massacre, which I know is sad.
Oh,
shifting into some sadness.
Oh, I've heard about
this. This is a good topic, though. Yeah, this is a good topic that deserves being talked about.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yes. So not really that big of a conspiracy, but important. So the year is 1921. The place is Tulsa, Oklahoma. Fueled by oil money, Tulsa was growing a growing prosperous city with a population of more than 100,000 people. But segregation kept tensions high, and in much of the country, there was a spike in racial tensions, including the resurgence of the white supremacist group, the Ku Klux Klan. It was very common for white mobs to lynch black people to keep them in their place, quote unquote. At this time as well, African Americans went to extensive effort to prevent attacks on their communities. And on a sad day in June, these efforts were not enough as a white mob obliterated a flourishing black neighborhood called Greenwood. Greenwood was the neighborhood in Tulsa where most African Americans lived because of segregation. In 1921, Greenwood had a population of nearly 10,000 people, including descendants of slaves. Black people also had migrated from all over to come to Greenwood to escape the harsher racial tensions in the Deep South. They heard about the thriving, successful community that the residents had built and wanted to experience a supportive black community. The heart of the booming neighborhood was a business district known as Black Wall Street. It was named after O.W. Gurley, a wealthy black landowner from Arkansas, who moved there and started opening businesses for black residents to own and run. He named the main street after Greenwood, Mississippi, and the name was later extended to the entire neighborhood. According to State Senator Kevin Matthews of Tulsa, Greenwood had restaurants, hotels, theaters, transportation services, and grocery stores all run and owned by black entrepreneurs. At least based on what we were taught in history class, at this time in America, it was unheard of for black Americans to have a community of their own, let alone for it to be flourishing. The narrative at this time seemed to be pressure for black people to assimilate into white America, keeping white people in the position of power. The fact that African Americans had found a way to build a nice life for themselves without involving white people was extremely threatening to the balance of power that racists wanted to uphold. That's why it is gut-wrenching but not surprising when racial tension started to boil over for an unrelated event and anger quickly turned to Greenwood as the representation of black power and independence, a threat that racists could not let go any longer. It began like so much racial violence with a false allegation that a black man had raped a white woman. The man was Dick Rowland, and he was accused of assaulting Sarah Page in an elevator on May 30th, 1921. No one knows for sure what happened, but a common suggestion is that Rowland may have tripped, and a catch-as-fall grabbed Page's arm. She screamed, and he, knowing the danger he was in, ran from the building. Rowland was arrested the next morning and jailed at the Tulsa County Courthouse. A year earlier at this courthouse, authorities allowed a lynch mob to kidnap a black man from custody. So when the Tulsa Tribune ran an inflammatory article, an editorial on May 31st, black Tulsans had every reason to fear that Rowland would be lynched, and no reason to believe the authorities would protect him. That evening, as hundreds of white Tulsans shouted for the sheriff to turn Rowland over, groups of armed black men showed up at the courthouse and told officials they were there to help defend it. Many white people went off to get their own weapons, and the crowd grew to more than 2,000. Finally, according to the 2001 commission report, a white man tried to grab a black man's gun. The gun went off, and the white mob spread out through the streets of downtown Tulsa, shooting black people on sight. The morning of June 1st, the mob rushed into Greenwood and opened fire with machine guns. They led black people out of their homes and businesses at gunpoint, looted valuables, and set the buildings on fire. Black residents tried to defend themselves but were overpowered. The mob stopped firefighters from reaching much of the burning neighborhood, while the police and National Guard arrested black people instead of the white rioters. In some cases, members of the Guard joined the rioters. After the massacre, officials set about erasing it from the city's historical record. This is where the conspiracy comes in. Victims were buried in unmarked graves. Police records vanished. The inflammatory Tulsa Tribune articles were cut out before the newspapers were transferred to microfilm. The first full history of the massacre wouldn't be written until 1982. Scott Ellsworth, a lecturer at the University of Michigan, wrote, "Death is a Promised Land," finally uncovering this untold, horrifying story. City officials cleansed the history books so thoroughly that when Nancy Feldman, a lawyer from Illinois, started teaching her students at the University of Tulsa about the massacre in the late 1940s, they didn't believe her. Mr. Matthews, the state senator, said that even as a black person raised in Tulsa, and even as the grandson of a woman who survived the massacre, he didn't learn about it until he was in his 20s. In the late 1960s, Don Ross, a reporter who later became a Democratic state legislator, began investigating the history of the massacre. As the dam began to crack, a researcher, Ed Wheeler, interviewed survivors, and in 1971 found a message on his windshield, "Best look under your hood from now on." Another quarter century passed before the breaking point. In 1995, when journalists flooded in to cover the terrorist truck bombing of Alfred P. Murrah, the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, Mr. Ross managed to get the attention of national outlets. Dr. Ellsworth said that led to television coverage in 1996, a burst of publicity, and ultimately the creation of the investigating commission, which they used to investigate racist crimes. In the immediate aftermath of the massacre, the Ku Klux Klan used it as a recruiting tool, and within months, its Tulsa chapter became one of the nation's largest. And at the same time, numerous black communities marshaled their money and resources to help Greenwood rebuild, said Phil Armstrong, but the damage had already been done. So that's the end of the story I wrote, but this was something that was, like, erased from history books. We never learned about, obviously.
I never learned about it in school.
I know. Yeah. I think I learned about it, like, through TikTok, like, which is so sad.
I think I heard about it on a podcast.
It's really difficult right now, especially because of the situations that we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. Because there are literally, there are now stories of entire African American predominant towns that were completely erased because of white supremacy and racism in the U.S. And while, yes, I do agree that this is, like, kind of conspiratorized because these places have been erased and sometimes you don't know if it's true or not, there is evidence that there's a whole town. I wish I knew where it was off the top of my head, but I listened to it on My Favorite Murder once, and it was a whole town that was primarily African American. They had their own businesses, their own movie theater. It was a happy place for them, and they came in and completely wrecked it, and it was all wrecked by the Ku Klux Klan and racist white people.
I think I heard of that one too from My Favorite.
It's
murder.
Insane because it's insane because these places haven't been talked about for years.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And they try to make it seem like when an African American family moves into your neighborhood, your cost of living is going to start going down, or not your cost of living, but the value of your neighborhood is going to start going down. But then they fail to realize that African-American people are not the problem. Mm-mm. They are not the problem.
Well, and it's funny that they tried to hide it so that people would think it was not real, or, you know, they tried to turn that into a conspiracy, but now people are realizing, like, oh, the conspiracy is that the U.S. government and the educational system tried to just erase
this. Yeah.
Right.
And, like, I know growing up, it, like, I went to a Catholic, like, predominantly white school. Like, when you learned about slavery, it was, like, I never even thought of, like, oh, communities of black people were living together and had their
harmoniously
right?
yeah
I just pictured them as the, you know, educational system wanted me to picture them, which was just trying to assimilate into a white culture, because that left us in not us but left white people in the position of power, and that's exactly what how they wanted it to stay.
Yeah.
And, you know, it, obviously this whole mob knowing to go to Greenwood, it's telling that tensions were definitely high and that this was a conversation that people had had before. Like, it's not like one person just led everyone there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it must have been a common understanding that, like, they did not like that this group, this community of people, were living such independent and great lives.
Yeah.
And it's just really sad.
It's just, it goes back into the whole, like, stay in your lane, mind your own business type of thing. Like, why can't you just let people be happy? Like, just
they're
because
pathetic.
They're not like you, why can't mm-hmm. you just let people be happy? That's why I have a problem with people that have a problem with, like, the LGBTQ community being happy, mm-hmm. African Americans being happy, Asian people living their lives. Like, just leave people alone. Let people be happy.
Right.
Let people yeah. live their lives. Don't worry about other people. Worry about yourself.
Well, especially in, like, the predominantly white, like, right-wing group, power is such a fetishized, like, need for people.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the driving force for all of this. So, like, they just cannot not be in power.
Oh, listen. I got into an argument with someone recently because I said middle-aged white man shouldn't be in control anymore. Let someone else take over. And they did not like that I said that white people should not be in charge anymore. And I was like, I don't want to be in charge. I know there are plenty of qualified people out there that are people of color, people of different backgrounds, non-cis people, non-binary people that could do a way better job than me as a cis white man. And they did not like that. And I went up to bat. I was ready to fight.
Yeah. Well, and it's even just so, like, dystopian to think about the world that patriarchy has created, where it's just default white, straight, cis men are just at the top. Like, so, you know, like, as growing up, it seems so normalized. Like, oh, yeah, they're the top of the food chain. And then next comes this group. Like, why is... they created that for themselves. That's
mm-hmm.
not how, like, nature is supposed to be. It's not like that's, it's all just a function of being in power. And
oh, I can't wait for the day that the white middle-aged men finally realize that they're fucked and people start taking over that they don't want, and they're like, then they become the minority.
Yeah.
I'll proudly be like, do your work.
Well, even just, that's what they say, like, you know, they should be happy that people don't want revenge, they just want equality. Like, it's not like
mm-hmm.
like the minority groups even want to be in power over them. It's just like, we just want an equal seat at the table.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's not like someone is trying to overpower them. Like, we're not trying to do to you what they did to us.
Yeah.
It's like, we just want you to treat everyone with respect. It's like, it's not even that much of a threat that, like, they think it is, you know, that we're trying to, like, you know, kill them off or whatever. Like, they think, you know, like, a white Republican is, like, the new minority. Like, we're not trying to make minorities. We just want everyone to be happy. Like,
well, I mean, in all fairness, the white middle-aged man with their conservative backgrounds could stand to step back a little bit and be a minority
mm-hmm.
for a while.
Yeah, but yeah, like that threat of, like, that's not the future that
no
they're
yeah.
fighting for, you know.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
but
yeah,
yeah, yes, that would be nice. Someone on one of my TikToks one time commented, like, oh, fine, no one will say anything anymore, I'll just stop talking. And I was like, that'd be great.
Perfect.
Thanks.
Great, shut up.
Thank you.
Love that. Yes. Like, thank you.
Yeah.
Love that for you, love that for us. No, shut the fuck up.
Exactly. But yeah, even back then, which especially back then, but even today, you know, not a surprise that the authorities are helping in destroying black communities and killing black people. Mm. So it's appropriate for these times as well.
Yeah.
I told you it was going to be sad.
My story is equally as sad.
Oh, okay, good. I'm not the only one.
It's like, it's fucked. I do just want to let everyone know that I am literally reading directly from an article by Michael East on Medium.com. It's called Unsolved Mysteries, Horror at Camp Scott, The Girl Scout Murders.
Ooh. Oh.
Okay. In rural Oklahoma, a once joyous summer camp is slowly being reclaimed by nature, left only to the advancing mold and the ghosts of so many moments of fun. While these moments likely still exist in the back of many former residents' minds, they surely are eclipsed by the horror of what transpired one rainy morning in 1977. By dawn, three schoolgirls were brutally raped and murdered, and the culprit would never officially be caught following an investigation where allegations of racism and corruption would run wild. On June 12, 1977, it was a rainy night at Camp Scott in rural Oklahoma. The camp was historic, founded 49 years before as one of the centerpieces of the Magic Empire Girl Scout Council out of Tulsa. The 410-acre compound sat between Snake Creek and Spring Creek just off Highway 82. It was the first day of camping, and a summer thunderstorm was thrashing the tents of a group of Girl Scouts from the Broken Arrow section of Tulsa. In Tent 8, the furthest away from the camp counselor, three young girls were huddled together for comfort, writing letters back to their families in the dark. They were Lori Lee Farmer, age 8, Michelle Heather Goose, age 9, and Doris Denise Milner, age 10. Lori was the youngest Girl Scout at the entire camp and was happy to meet new friends. She was one of five children and the daughter of Dr. Charles, or Beau, Farmer, and his wife, Sherry. Lori actually couldn't decide between attending Girl Scout camp or attending a summer camp sponsored by the YMCA, and her mom, Sherry, actually decided that Lori was going to go to Girl Scout camp that summer, and she regrets that decision to this day.
Oh, that's so sad. Oh, my God.
I know.
Imagine
so
living
sad.
With that on your conscience for the rest of your life.
Like, it's not obviously not her fault, but still, like.
Right.
Just
a twist of fate could have
changed.
That's
so sad. Mm-hmm. Oh, no. I'm sad. Oh,
I know.
No.
I know. It's sad.
Oh.
And meanwhile, wait, what? Okay, just kidding. Meanwhile, Lori's bunkmate, Michelle, had already attended the camp the previous year and was super excited to be returning. She was described as athletic and active and really loved being outdoors. It seems pretty likely that the other girls would have looked up to her because she had been at the camp before. And especially Denise Milner, who was very, very anxious about the trip. Denise's mother, Betty, said that she was worried about attending and had almost decided she didn't want to go. And Betty convinced her otherwise. Denise was a young girl and a straight-A student, and she sold enough Girl Scout cookies to attend this camp. After writing their letters back home to their family, the three girls went to sleep as the rain continued to lash down. Partially obscured by the camp showers, nobody would see the horror to come. And I actually heard, I don't know if it was on a different podcast or something that covered this, but one of the camp counselors told Lori to write a letter back home to her mom. Oh, wait, no. Lori wanted to call her mom that night, but the camp counselor said, like, because she knew that it was, like, literally, like, the first night of camp, and the counselor knew that she was, like, really, really nervous, so she was like, okay, just write a letter to your family, like, we're not going to call her because it's just going to make them, it's just going to make you feel like more like homesick and you'll want to go home. Like, and I want you to enjoy this kind of thing, which is also very sad.
It's like these girls had intuition, like they did not want to go.
I know.
And they were like nervous.
I know.
Man, that's so sad.
Around 6 a.m. the next day, camp counselor Carla Wilhite would discover the bound body of one of the girls wrapped in a sleeping bag on a trail about 150 yards from their tent. The other two bodies were found quickly afterward, one in the open and the other in a sleeping bag. All three girls had been raped and bludgeoned before being strangled to death.
This is the worst. Oh no.
Why are we talking about this?
I know. It's depressing.
Oh. This might be the saddest story that you've told.
It might be. It might be. Camp Scott would immediately become a major crime scene and was evacuated 4 hours later. They came under immediate criticism, ensuring that they called their insurance company and a lawyer before informing the parents that their children had been killed. Meanwhile, the police were quickly at work and ascertained that the killings took place between 2 a.m. and 4 a.m., and all three children were held and killed in their own tent. The tent flooring was absolutely covered in blood, and it appeared that the killer or killers had made an attempt to cover up the crime. They were trying to wipe the pools of blood up with towels and a mattress. A footprint was found outside the tent from a tennis shoe. A different print was found inside. Other significant evidence found at the scene included fingertips on the bodies, cord, duct tape, and a red flashlight that had been left on top of one of the girls' bodies. There was what seemed to be a bloody fingerprint on the lens. A witness stated that he had heard quite a bit of traffic near the camp around the believed time of the killings, and it seemed that it would only be a matter of time before arrests were made. Questions asked of camp staff revealed that the slaughter may not have been a spur-of-the-moment opportunism, with some evidence that the camp has been watched for a while. Just 2 months prior, a camp counselor discovered that her belongings had been ransacked and a box of donuts were emptied, the contents presumably eaten. Inside the box, a note had been left that stated, "We are on a mission to kill three girls in tent one."
Oh my God.
The camp director treated the message as a joke, and other staff would report hearing noises around Camp Scott, with dogs often being on alert. After bringing in tracking dogs, police believed they had found the murder weapon on June 16th. Publicly revealing it to have been a crowbar and saying that more fingerprints were found. While no suspects had been officially identified, the press were already speculating that an escaped convict by the name of Jean Leroy Hart may have been involved. However, the case was already beginning to break down, with internal tensions being very public. District Attorney Sid Wise openly began to correct the record on Sheriff Glenn Weaver's statements, denying the murder weapon was found and stating that there were no suspects. Weaver claimed that there was one. Just a day after the denial, Wise would say it was, in truth, several suspects, a statement backed by the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation. The murder weapon would eventually be said to have been an axe taken from the camp. Meanwhile, with the dog's help, police located a cave around 2 miles away that appeared to have been lived in. Inside the cave were eyeglasses stolen from Camp Scott, duct tape, a flashlight battery, and two photographs featuring three women that investigators linked to Hart, who was that escaped convict. The cave was just 100 feet from a cellar and foundation that had been Jean Hart's childhood home. Writing on the wall of another nearby cave read, "The killer was here. Bye-bye, fools. 77-16-17. Coming under increased public criticism and scrutiny, a media blackout would be imposed on investigators. This general feeling soon began to boil into a tinderbox of racial tension as Gary Leroy Hart was allegedly spotted in the camp's vicinity. A Cherokee Native American, Hart had been convicted of kidnapping and raping two pregnant women and had been on the run since 1973 after escaping Mays County Jail. Gossip locally was that he was being sheltered in the area. These tensions threatened to boil over on June 24th when 200 lawmen and 400 volunteers surrounded a four-mile area around Camp Scott, many civilians being armed and drunk. Wow, that's great. The tensions rose yet further when members of the American Indian Movement also descended onto the area to monitor the activities of what they called a posse. A former Mays County jailer would later testify that he had been told Hart was not to be captured alive. Thankfully, the event passed without incident, and on June 29th, the FBI sent 40 agents to assist the investigation. Ben Hyatt of the American Indian Movement would later accuse Sheriff Weaver of stirring up the tensions, saying that he had created a mob situation and that there was a feeling this is being built up against our people in this case. So there was like this whole like tension against Native Americans during this time. Jeff Laird, the director of the OSBI, would call a conference on July 6th. Stating that previous evidence believed to have been fingerprints had not been what the Bureau thought they were. But significant evidence pointed to Hart's guilt. After local sheriffs also publicly stated that the suspect was guilty, questions began to be raised over the possibility of an unfair trial should Hart actually be caught. Such was the concern that by August, Oklahoma Governor David Boren released a statement saying that he would use the powers of his office to assure his security and a fair trial if he will give himself up. However, Hart didn't surrender and would remain on the run for almost another year, with the cost of the manhunt exceeding $1,250,000 in today's currency. However,
that's crazy,
right? However, the search would end on April 6, 1978, when a team of agents from the OSBI stormed a house in Cherokee County near Bunch, owned by Sam Pigeon, taking the suspect into custody and transporting him immediately to the Oklahoma State Penitentiary, and Pigeon was charged with harboring a fugitive. Gene Leroy Hart's trial commenced on March 19, 1979, and would last until May 30th. The proceedings were one of the most significant and most sensational trials in Oklahoma history, with the opinions divided along racial lines. Support for Hart was strong with the local Cherokee, and sizable donations were accepted from the community, and fundraisers were organized to assist in his defense. A defense HQ was set up at Hart Hotel, just a half block from the courthouse, and in one controversial case, 35 fourth grade children undertook a vote in class on Hart's guilt, finding him innocent by 32 votes to 3. The prosecution highlighted a mirror and a corncob pipe found in Sam Pigeon's house as items taken from Camp Scott, and that hair found attached to the duct tape was found to have the same general characteristics as Hart. It's okay. So sick. They noted that eyeglasses and a glasses case were in the hideout cave found by the tracking dogs. In 1966, Hart abducted two pregnant women in Tulsa, took them to the woods, and violently raped them and sodomized them both. Both had worn glasses, and he would try them on during a car ride before the assaults. Hart had admitted the offenses, and most believe that he had intended to kill both victims. When he was arrested, Hart was wearing women's glasses. Meanwhile, Hart's defense indirectly accused Sheriff Weaver of planting evidence and offered an alternative suspect, that being William Stevens, a convicted rapist. Giving witness testimony, a waitress named Mrs. Dean Boyd positively identified Stevens as a man she had seen in her cafe on the morning of the killings. Located 15 miles away from Camp Scott, Boyd stated that Stevens ate at the cafe between 5 a.m. and 6 a.m. and seemed pretty nervous. An 11-year-old scout from the camp testified that she had seen Stevens at Camp Scott in the days before the murders. Other witnesses at the trial stated that the red flashlight found at the scene was one that they had loaned to Stevens and his friend Dwayne Peters just a few weeks before the murders. They added that the new suspect had come to their home after the killings with scratches on his arms and neck, and there was even blood on his boots. Peters would tell investigators that Stevens had admitted the atrocity to him in October of 1977 while the two were drunk. Peters would allege that his friend had been working on an oil rig near Camp Scott, having been raised in the area, knew that the Girl Scouts would be coming when they did. He placed the camp under surveillance, utilizing tactics that he had learned during service in Vietnam, and deliberately selected the most isolated tent for his attack. Covering the lens of the flashlight they had borrowed with duct tape, a small incision was made so as not to alert anyone else in the camp before entering and committing the crime. Stevens denied working on an oil rig, stated he didn't know the area, and even rejected borrowing the flashlight. State investigators noted that blood and semen samples had been taken from both men and ruled them out as suspects in the case. The trial's closing was ill-tempered, with shouting seen inside the court chamber and scuffles outside before the jury of six men and six women took just 5 minutes to find Jean Leroy Hart innocent of all charges.
Wow.
Sheriff Weaver stated that he was shocked and disgusted by the ruling and decided the case would not be reopened. He told the press that we had the man we were after. The OSBI was in agreement, also stating that they had captured the right man. Following the verdict, Hart was placed in protective custody before being transferred to the Oklahoma State Penitentiary to continue his 308-year sentence for the 1966 rapes. He died...
Wow.
Right, 308 years. That's crazy. He died of a heart attack on June 4th, 1979, just 2 months after the conclusion of the Girl Scout murders trial. Meanwhile, the Farmers and Milners sued the Magic Empire Girl Scout Council over the deaths, but lost the case in 1985. Sherry Farmer would become an outspoken advocate for the victims of crime, forming the Oklahoma chapter of Parents of Murdered Children. In 1989, DNA testing on samples from the crime scene would show that 3 of the 5 probes matched Hart's DNA, with 1 in 7,700 Native Americans having the same result. Whether Jean Hart was guilty and whether an accomplice walked free is still a matter of great contention in Oklahoma. There is little doubt that Hart was not the saint nor innocent party that many suggested he was, being guilty of 2 brutal rapes and with significant evidence against him for the Girl Scout murders. While his defenders contend that evidence was planted and Sheriff Weaver's conduct can be rightly questioned at several points during the investigation, there is no evidence that there was any organized conspiracy against Hart. Equally, however, the evidence against William Stevens cannot be ignored either, despite samples seemingly ruling him out. With both men dead, it seems unlikely that the truth happened, that what truly happened that dark morning at Camp Scott will ever be known. Their deaths being little comfort to 3 families whose pain would only endure. And that is the story of the Girl Scout murders in Oklahoma.
That's a lot. That was a heavy story.
Yeah. It's definitely a lot. There's actually a whole entire website called GirlScoutMurders.com that has all, like, literally any information that you could ever want on it if you are intrigued. But the camp did close and after that incident, and it's still to this day is just like overgrowing with grass and stuff.
It could be that I just started watching the Night Stalker documentary on Netflix, but that story really reminded me of the camp from American Horror Story 1985.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that does.
But yeah, I remember hearing about this on probably My Favorite Murder, but I know like Crime Junkie and like everyone has covered it. And I think True Crime Garage also did a couple episodes on it. It's just really interesting how like everything happened. And like to this day, like obviously they think that Hart is the guy. But, like, will we really ever know?
And what's here it is, all the evidence they have against Hart was, like, too perfect. It was, like,
right.
Yeah.
They found his hideout cave with pictures of his other victims. Right. And, like, who, I mean, if you were going to plant evidence, that's what I would plant.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that's just insane. I don't know what to think.
Yeah. Right.
It's crazy.
Oh. Yeah.
Oh, well, let's wrap this up with a haunted hotel.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah.
Something so, light and airy.
Light yes. and airy and multiple stories tall. Tonight I'm doing the Skirvin Hotel in Oklahoma City. It was first opened in 1911. The Skirvin Hotel contained 225 rooms and a 10-story two-winged tower. A third 12-story wing was added in 1925, and then in 1929 to 1930, all three wings were leveled off to 14 floors with a total of 525 rooms. It was also one of the first buildings in Oklahoma City to have air conditioning, which was then called iced air.
Iced air.
Which I thought was a valuable fact to put in.
Yeah,
that is interesting.
Yeah. In addition to having air conditioning, the hotel also featured running ice water in each room, a ballroom that seated 500 people, and imported Austrian chandeliers that cost more than $100,000 each.
Wow.
Fancy. The hotel is named after the founder, William Balzer, or Bill Skirvin, whose daughter, Pearl Mesta, became the ambassador to the Luxembourg under her Harry Truman. The hotel closed in 1988 and sat abandoned for most of the 19 years until it was renovated and reopened as part of the Hilton chain in 2007. The renovation project restored the original exterior finish, installed historically accurate windows, reconfigured guest rooms, and added new guest elevators. The process to return the hotel to life started nearly a decade earlier, however, when in 1999, Oklahoma City Mayor Kirk Humphreys appointed a Skirvin Solutions Committee to evaluate, whether or not the historic building could be saved. The committee started its work by touring other restored historic hotels, looking at how those projects were paid for, and then recommended in October of 2000 that the city of Oklahoma explore creating a public-private partnership to get Skirvin reopened. In May of 2002, Oklahoma City acquired the building from its current owners for $2.875 million and issued a request for proposals from potential developers late the same year. Partners in Development, a firm put together... What? Hello? Partners in Development, a firm put together by Principal John Weeman, made a proposal to renovate the building for $42.1 million and to reopen it as a full-service Hilton operated by Marcus Hotels and Resorts. The Oklahoma City Urban Renewal Authority selected Partners in Development as a developer in 2004, and Weeman bought the building from Oklahoma City in 2005, and using the money, he invested plus funds from various other public sources, including tax increment, financing, grants, empowerment, zone credits, historic tax credits, and new market tax credits, completed its renovation for $51 million. I know this is all very boring, but some people really care about the history and what I'm talking about.
Well, to get the gist of it all, you need the history.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. But we're going to get to the fun stuff right now.
Woo!
It's also very beautiful. I've been looking at pictures of it.
It is, yeah. So the Oklahoma City Showplace became a popular speakeasy during Prohibition. It was during that time that W.B. Skirvin was said to have had an affair with one of his hotel maids. According to legend, the maid soon conceived, and in order to prevent a scandal, she was locked in a room on the top floor of the hotel. The desolate girl soon grew depressed, and even after the birth of her child, she was still not let out of the room. Half out of her mind, she finally grabbed the infant child and threw herself, along with the baby, out of a window.
The hell? Mm-hmm.
The maid's name, yeah, it's... I feel like this is one of those, like, movie stories that, like, you think isn't true, but it very much is.
Yeah,
that's so sad.
Yeah. The maid's name remains unknown, but her ghost continues to haunt the Skirvin Hotel, and she was nicknamed Effie by former employees. Though the hotel closed in 1988, former guests would often report not being able to obtain a decent night's sleep due to a consistent sound of a child crying. Effie was apparently a woman of loose morals, and many men who have stayed in the hotel have often reported being propositioned by a female voice while alone in their rooms. Others have seen a figure of a naked woman with them while taking a shower. One man even claimed he was sexually assaulted by an invisible entity during his stay.
Oh my god.
That's spooky.
What the fuck?
What is that? It's not a, what's a sex demon called?
Succubus?
Succubus. Yeah. Sounds like she's a succubus.
Oh yeah, probably.
Other strange noises and occurrences were reported by staff and guests, including things seemingly being moved around by themselves, such as a maid's cart being pushed down the hall when no one was there. Despite millions of dollars being spent to renovate the historic hotel, Effie allegedly still continues to reside there to this day. According to NBA players from the New York Knicks, they claim their game was off after a night of haunts at the hotel in 2010. So have many other NBA players that have stayed at the hotel. According to 2014 New York Times article, maybe the ghost is attracted to NBA players, as there was another experience in 2016 by the Los Angeles Lakers. So she's really coming after these men.
I mean,
yeah.
Is what I'm hearing.
Hmm.
So some other visitors have also been quoted with their experiences. One saying, the city of Oklahoma City needs to abandon the Skirvin Hotel project. I've been inside before the renovation started in 2004. You can see objects moving with no one else around to be moving them. Crying and screaming of a woman, I just don't think it's a good idea to be messing around with that place. Another quote, I've actually been in there and it is really haunted. You can see the woman standing in the window she jumped out of.
Ooh,
when you see her, she is at first standing far away and then runs up to the window and stops.
Mm.
Oh.
That's scary.
You can test your ghostly luck if you're interested in staying the night in the haunted hotel. Rooms there start at $179 for a standard two double, and a one bedroom rotunda suite starts at $199 a night. But keep your eye or your ears open for lost souls, because you never know what you'll find when you turn a corner in the Skirvin Hotel.
It definitely looks like it's haunted.
Yeah, I'm looking at pictures right now.
It looks like the hotel kind of that I picture. I know this is not the same one, but the Kill music video, I know that's based on like The Shining. Mm-hmm. But it looks like a hotel that has that vibe.
Super spooky.
If we're ever in Oklahoma, we'll have to go. I don't know if we ever will be, but
okay. A little preview of what is to come while we're in Austin. I think tomorrow we're going to try to go get drinks at the Driscoll Hotel, which is also a very haunted hotel. And other podcasters that I listen to have stayed in that hotel and talk about how haunted it was for them. So I'm really excited to go get drinks there tomorrow.
You should like walk around and kind of like vlog yourself a little bit.
Yes. Put it on our Insta.
Yeah. I feel like it's one of those things where once I go there, I'm going to have to do that for my Texas story.
Mm-hmm.
So we might have to, Texas might be one of those ones that we have to revisit because it's such a big state.
Yeah, definitely. That's spooky. I'm excited for you.
Yeah, I'm really interested. I wanted to go to the steakhouse, but it's closed right now because of COVID. So, that's yeah.
Sad.
That sucks.
Well, if you're looking for any other way to find us, not being dickheads and following the rules, you can follow us on Instagram at Tipsy Ghouls Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter and TikTok, even though we don't really do a ton there, but we do kind of shit post on TikTok every once in a while. Not TikTok, Twitter. You can also send us emails if you have a really great story to share, even if it's from a state that we've already covered, at tipsyghoulspodcast@gmail.com. If you want to support us in any ways other than that, you can also purchase a button that we sell on our Etsy page, which is Tipsy Ghouls Podcast on Etsy, and our buttons are $3.99, which includes the shipping. You can also join our Patreon for $5 and get an extra bonus content, and once we start getting people, we will definitely start uploading the extra bonus content. Lastly, but not leastly, if you want to give us a fun little free gift from you to us, you can rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, which will boost us up so that other people can discover us. Or if you don't even want to do that, you can just tell your friends and family about us, because word of mouth is a great way to also talk about us and let other people know that we exist. If you want to see us do anything, let us know. Slide into our DMs wherever you find us. That's about it. Please tell us what you think. Tell us how much you love us. Tell us if you hate us. I don't know. We can't grow without the haters, too.
Exactly. Are you panhandle? I almost said panhandle pussies. Are you panhandle?
Are you panhandle pussies ready to go?
I can't think of anything else. panhandle parakeets.
Are you Rocky Mountain oysters ready to
rest? Oh my god. That's the best. Oh my god. Yes, I am.
Yes.
Do you want to say that beach since you're the one who's doing this?
No, I think that would get to sleep.
All right. Here we go.
Just know when it comes to Black history, what we've been taught in school might not be the truth. So do your own research, learn the truth about Black history in America.
Please stop killing women and girls.
Yes.
Off that, don't lock your fucking mistress in a room for her to have a fucking baby and then not expect her to jump out the fucking window. I don't fucking know.
Yeah, that's a good tip.
Yep.
Yeah. Maybe don't lock your mistress. Maybe if you're going to have a mistress, just fucking put a ring on it. I don't fucking know.
Or
I don't
just
know.
Don't have
I'm
a
never
going to
have a mistress. Yeah. Or just don't have it. Yeah,
or
divorce
just treat
the one
women with respect, you know.
Or just treat women with respect. Yeah.
You do that too.
I don't know.
That one might be a little bit too hard though.
That's too radical, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit too radical.
Too much. Yeah. Pull back. Anyways. Until next time.
Question everything. Goodbye.
Goodbye. No business, just fun.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah, no recording. Just
no recording
fun times.
While I'm home, just a day of pleasure.
Yes.
Yes.
Pleasure. Yes. No working vacations.
All
no.
Pleasure, no work.
All pleasure.
Ew.
Tipsy girls, all pleasure.
Cheeks Mitt Gentleman's Club. All pleasure.
All pleasure, no work.
Are you tired of podcasting? Come to Cheap Gentleman's Club. All pleasure.
Joanne's Fabrics.
Joanne Fabrics. All pleasure. No work.
Are you tired of your middle-aged mom days? Joanne Fabrics. All pleasure.
All pleasure.
Are you, Are you tired of your husband and kids nagging you? What's for dinner? Take a
come
little
get a craft
to Joanne Fabrics. All pleasure, no work.
All of your wood and fabric needs.
All of your rustic farmhouse dreams will become true at Joanne Fabrics.